not dealing with them, but teaching the kids. And quite honestly, I'm hoping that you're teaching the adults even more than what you're teaching the kids, because there's been some really good lessons in that stuff. All right, so kids, since you're kind of paying attention for the moment, let me ask you a question. If one evening, it's getting really close to supper time, mom just says, you know what, no dinner tonight, I just don't feel like it. No food in the house, stay out of the fridge, just no one's getting dinner tonight. How would that go over? What's the first things that starts going through your mind? There's a word for it that somebody invented. They're pretty smart. They call it hangry. You ever heard that term? You start getting irritated. It doesn't matter why you're not getting food. So why would you get angry? Well, because you had an expectation of food, didn't you? And then all of a sudden, your expectation of food became unmet. We're going to talk about unmet expectations. And we're going to start off with a story in the Bible. I think most of us are pretty familiar with it. Genesis 28. We've got Jacob here. We're going to read a part of his story. And there's a lot of unmet expectations in that story. Genesis 28, starting in verse 1, says, "And Isaac called Jacob and blessed him and charged him and said unto him, You should not take a wife of the daughters of Canaan. Arise and go up to Paddan Aram, to the house of Bethuel, your mother's father, and take thee a wife from hence of the daughters of Laban, your mother's brother. And have God bless thee and make thee fruitful and multiply, that you now may be a multitude of people, and give thee blessings, and give you the blessing of Abraham to you and your seed and with thee, that you may inherit the land wherein thou art a stranger, which God gave to your grandfather Abraham. And Isaac sent away Jacob, and he went to Paddan Aram unto Laban, son of Bethuel the Syrian, the brother of Rebekah, Jacob and Esau's mother." Do you remember what happens next? So here we got to the point where Jacob is ready for a wife, and his father agrees with that. And Isaac doesn't want Jacob to take just any wife. He wants to take one from his own clan, in a sense. And so sends him to an uncle that he's never met before, and to see if there's some prospects over there. Now, Jacob has heard the story from his father, Isaac, and potentially from his grandfather, Abraham. But he's heard the stories of God's miraculous intervention in their family's lives. He knows what God has promised them and even him, because God promised Abraham he would make from him many nations, right? So he knows he's a part of that. And now his father has just blessed him and reminded him of those promises. And as he sets out, can you imagine what's on his mind? If you were in Jacob's shoes, going down the road towards an uncle you never met to acquire a wife, what would be on your mind? He's probably excited about that, because it sounds like he was ready, willing to become a father or a husband. He probably expected that, this trip is probably going to take me several weeks, just a handful of weeks. I'm going to go there, find a wife, bring her back here, settle down, raise a family, kind of thing. That he would have God's blessing on all that. He'd get his wife home. There'd be a picket fence, two cars in the driveway, chickens out back, kids and puppies on the way, right? lots of great expectations. On the way, he stops for the night. He has a dream. Do you remember the story of Jacob's ladder? He dreams about this ladder, this staircase that goes up to heaven. And God tells him something very specific. And we read about that again in the same chapter, Genesis 28, but now we're down in verse 14. And God tells Jacob, "And your seed shall be as the dust of the earth." If you pick up a handful of soil, how many grains of sand are in there? Can you take a guess?
It depends on how big the hand is.
It's innumerable in one sense, right? I mean, we just don't want to sit there and count how many would be in a handful. But God says, of the dust of the earth, innumerable, infinite, way beyond imagination. "And thou shalt spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and the south, and in thee and thy seed shall the families of the earth be blessed." So God doesn't even not only say that he's going to bless him with abundance in terms of, you know, his family spreading and spreading around the world, but that his family, those offspring, would be a blessing to the entire world. In verse 15, "And behold, I am with you, and will keep thee in all the places where you goest, and will bring thee again into this land, for I will not leave you until I have done that which I have spoken of." So God says, I'm with you, I'm going to protect you, everything I just said is going to be done, and in fact, all of this will be done, and I'm going to bring you back to this place, and then you'll know what's been done. So now, he's back on the road, his expectations, do you think they changed? They grew even larger? Because God just told him this incredible promise. And how do you wrap your head around that? Your families, Aiden, can you imagine if God says, your family is going to populate the world. It's going to, wherever you go around the earth, there's going to be some of Aiden's family. It's hard to wrap your head around, right? I think his expectations did expand. All of us have and create expectations. An expectation, it's something should or will be done, or something or someone will or should do something. That's an expectation. Sometimes we feel like something is owed to us or due to us. That's an expectation. And when our expectations are unmet, it can bring out anger, like we already talked about, hurt, frustration, withdrawal, depression. Our expectations can be based on hopes. I hope or I expect to get married one day. They can be based upon promises. They told me they would pick me up at 8 p.m. What happens if 8:15 gets there and they still haven't arrived? You wait longer, but there's an unmet expectation, and now what does that do to you inwardly? Maybe it's worry. It's like, they're never late. Something must be wrong. Now fear sets in, right? Or it could be anger. Oh, they told me they'd pick me up, and again, I believed them, but again, they're following their same old routine. They're late again. It'll be another 10 minutes, and finally they'll get here. Our expectations can also be based upon historical. It's always been done that way. Why should we change it? That's the way it's always been. And all of a sudden somebody wants to do something a little bit different, or we've never done that before. Our expectations can be based upon rules. If I'm out on the highway and someone's coming up beside me and they want to turn into my lane, they're going to turn on their turn signal, right? Law says so. They have to do it. I expect them to do that. No, no, they're cutting me off. I didn't know they were going to turn into my lane that abruptly. So again, what happens when our expectations are not met? What happens is emotions that can lead us to do things too quickly, without thinking, that can lead us to do things in vengeance, or even in hate. But back to Jacob. So he's been on this trip for a few days, had that vision from God, and he arrives at his uncle's, meets a girl, falls in love, right? Now he's got some new expectations. He's met the one. So, again, he's ready to go home in just a couple more days. Let's pick up the story now in Genesis 29 and verse 18. It says, "And Jacob loved Rachel and said to his uncle, 'I will serve you 7 years for Rachel, thy younger daughter.'" I don't know how that conversation came around. Was there just an expectation that if he didn't have a dowry with him? I don't know if he did or not. I know he took some things with him. But for whatever reason, this conversation comes around where he says he will serve Laban, his uncle, for 7 years before he gets married. And makes it very clear that he understands it's the younger daughter. And Laban says, "It is better that I give her to you than that I should give her to another man. Abide with me." So fulfill your 7 years. And Jacob served 7 years for Rachel, and that seemed to him but a few days, because he was in love. So 7 years have went by. He's had to work for his uncle. The day comes. He's fulfilled his duty. What's his expectations? Today? Tomorrow? Next week? We're packing up, and I'm taking my family home, right? 29 and verse 25. "And it came to pass that in the morning, behold, it was Leah, and he said to Laban, his uncle, 'What have you done to me? I served you for 7 years for Rachel. Why have you beguiled me? Why did you do this to me?'" Because he finds out he didn't marry Rachel. He married the older sister, Leah. There's a whole lot of unmet expectations that just took place. Jacob thought he was marrying Rachel. Finds out that he's actually been duped by the uncle, and he's married Leah. Still loves Rachel. What's he going to do about that? Planned on going home in a day or two with his new bride. What about Rachel? Rachel, a year or two ago, she wasn't very old. She's young, but when I say that, 14, 15, a couple years ago, she's thinking, "Can't wait for my knight in shining armor to ride up on a horse. We'll fall in love, get married, have kids." And then, lo and behold, one day, some guy just comes riding up. They see each other, they fall in love. He wants to marry her. That's what's going to take place. And the wedding day comes, and her dad pulls her inside and said, "You go stay in that closet till I tell you to come out." What do you mean? What's going on? We don't know how that worked out. I don't know if she had to stay in a closet or what, but somehow she was removed from the ceremony. What do you think was going through her head? But then Leah, a few months ago, a couple of years ago, was thinking or heard, "My sister's engaged. I'm going to get to be a bridesmaid, maybe the maid of honor. I'm excited. Be a nice party. Can't wait." On the day of the wedding, her dad comes to her, says, "Put this real heavy veil on. Go stand here." "No, I'm supposed to stand over here." "No, you stand here." What do you think going through her head? What was her expectations? Whew. But the twist in the plot of the story keeps turning, coming, right? Jacob has to serve another 7 years for Rachel, works on another agreement with this Laban. Then that wasn't enough. He did get to marry Rachel then at the end of another 7 years. So he's been there for 14 years. Thought he was only be gone for a few weeks, right? Wants to leave at the end of the 14 years with his two wives and now family that's starting to grow. And Laban says, "Well, no, don't take away my two daughters and my grandchildren. Stay here." So he agrees to stay 7 more years again. So he's agreed to stay 21 years in a place he thought he was only going to be for a week or two. So what's the reaction when we're faced with an unmet expectation? What about multiple unmet expectations? What about years of unmet expectations? Well, first we have to consider our own expectations. Were they reasonable? I think for Jacob's part, most of his were fairly reasonable. But there's a lot of times when you and I create unreasonable expectations. Oh, they said they'd be here at 8 o'clock. I know they've got a habit of being late, but he said this time he'll be here by 8 o'clock. So I know that's what I know this time he's not going to fail. Is that realistic? Is that unreasonable? So when he doesn't show up at 8 o'clock, is it reasonable for us to be irritated, frustrated, angry, mad, hurt? So the big reality here is most of our unmet expectations happens when others don't read or follow our script. That makes sense? We planned it all out in our head. We just knew this is the way it has to happen, it's going to happen. And then when others screw it up, we have the right to be upset with them. So should we be writing the script? Let's go to 2 Kings 5. 2 Kings 5 and verse 1 is another story here about Naaman. It says, "Now Naaman was captain of the host of the king of Syria." So he is really high up in the army. Basically, he's the highest ranking general of the king of Syria's army. He was a great man with his master and honorable because of him, the Lord had given him deliverance into Syria. He was also a mighty man of valor, but he was a leper. So he's a great man of stature. He's general of the army. People do look up to him, treat him good. Everywhere he goes, he kind of gets the red carpet treatment. But he's got this problem. He's got leprosy. And Naaman's wife's maid, she had a maid, and one day she mentions to his wife, you know, he could be healed over in Israel. So whether Naaman's wife or Naaman himself goes to the king of Syria and just says, I've heard, and I think it might be true, that if I went over to Israel, I could be healed. And the king of Syria said, that would be fantastic. Here, let me help you. I'm going to give you some things, send you on your way. In fact, I'm going to write a letter asking the king of Israel to bless, heal you, take care of you, and I'm going to send some gifts along. Second Kings 5, verse 5. The king of Syria said, Go, and I will send a letter to the king of Israel. And he departed, and he took with him 10 talents of silver and 6,000 pieces of gold and 10 changes of raiment. And he brought the letter to the king of Israel, saying, now when the letter has come unto thee, behold, I have therewith sent Naaman, my servant, to you, that you may recover him of his leprosy, heal him of his leprosy. And again, Naaman is a prominent figure. He's used to being treated. He's used to being around people like kings. So he's expecting the king to greet him, you know, with open arms, especially with this letter from the king of Syria. In verse 7, it says, and it came to pass when the king of Israel had read the letter that he tore his clothes and said, am I God to kill and make alive, that this man descend unto me to recover or heal a man of his leprosy? Wherefore consider, I pray you, and see how he seeks a quarrel against me. So the king of Israel is going, what's wrong with this guy? These people, they think I'm some type of God? Verse 8, and it was so, when Elisha the man of God had heard that the king of Israel had rent his clothes, that he sent to the king, saying, why have you torn your clothes? Let him now, meaning Naaman, come to me, and he shall know that there is a prophet in Israel. So now Elisha is saying, you know, send him over to me, and if God will heal him, then everyone will know that there is a prophet in Israel. Verse 9, so Naaman came with his horses and with his chariot, and he stood at the door of the house of Elisha. So he walks up to this house. The king of Israel has told Elisha, okay, fine, I'll send him down to you. Naaman knows that. So how would he expect to be greeted? Kind of with red carpet again, right? Doesn't happen quite that way. Verse 10, and Elisha sends out, doesn't answer the door, has a messenger open up the door, and says to Naaman, go and wash in the Jordan 7 times, and thy flesh shall become again to thee, and you shall be clean. Naaman's expecting Elisha to come out and say, hey, nice to meet you. That Naaman's expecting him to do something really great. Oh, I'm so glad you're here. You know what? I set aside this coming Friday evening, we're going to have a special service, and in front of everybody, we're going to bring you up, we're going to heal you, and everybody's going to be happy and excited. Naaman was probably expecting that there would be some type of audience that would go, ooh, ah. But in Naaman's book, the way this just happened, a messenger comes out and says, Elisha knows all about you. He said, just go wash in this river 7 times. And Naaman's script, didn't call for any of that. In fact, Naaman's script wouldn't have called for that particular river because that's not good enough in his script. He's literally ready to go back home with his leprosy and sulk, pout, whine, moan, grieve. But at least one of his servants, it sounds like a handful of them, come up to him. 2 Kings 5 and verse 13. And his servants came near and spoke to him, said, "My father, if the prophet had bid thee to do some great thing, wouldn't you have done it? How much rather then, when he said to thee, 'Wash and be clean,' told you to go do something really simple, why not go do that?" So finally Naaman goes, "Fine, I'll do it." And he went down, dipped himself 7 times in the Jordan, according to the saying of the man of God, Elisha, and the flesh came again like unto the flesh of a little child, and he was clean. So what he had hoped to happen took place, but it was nothing that was inside of his script. So again, whose narrative are we trying to live out? Ours or God's? We need to keep in mind that God's not looking for a story. He's looking for a person. He's looking for someone who will treat him as God, the one and only God, the God who's sovereign, but loving, fully capable, the God who sent a son as our Redeemer. If we go to James 1 and verse 2, you know these verses too. "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall in diverse temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith works patience. But let patience have her perfect work, that you may be perfect and entire, wanting nothing." Are we letting God direct and write the script? Are we patiently letting him unfold his plan and in his perfect timing rather than ours? James 1 and verse 5 says, "If any of you lack wisdom, let him ask God and give to all that he gives to all men liberally and unabraded, that it shall be given him. But let him ask in faith, nothing wavering, for he that wavereth is like a wave in the sea, driven with the wind and tossed. For let not that man think that he shall receive anything of the Lord." So now we're told that if we're going to let God write the script, shouldn't we go to him daily and ask him, what's our orders for today? What's our line on the script today? How does he want us to maneuver through everything that's going to take place today, tomorrow, next week? And the biggest thing we have to realize is that God is not out to destroy us. He loves us. He's out to destroy sin. If we choose to attach ourselves to sin, there's a big problem. So as a goldsmith, we've kind of talked about this before. God treats us as if we are gold that's just been mined out of the earth. That gold has some impurities along with it, inside of it. It could be other metals. It could be dirt. But again, God still treats the nuggets that are impure as gold. They're very valuable, but he wants them to become even more than what they are when they were mined. So even though he treats it with great care, because he's aware of its full potential, the impurities must be removed. And that process is not easy or light. So as a goldsmith, if I want to refine gold, I have to get those other metals and impurities out. The first thing I'm probably going to do is I'm going to put in a crucible and I'm going to heat it up to over 2,000 degrees. The gold's going to melt, become molten at about 1,800 degrees. At 2,000 degrees, there's a lot of other metals and or contaminants that will literally burn off. So I've removed quite a few things, impurities, just by heating it up. Didn't hurt the gold at all. I just changed its shape for the moment. But then, even though I've got gold that is much cleaner than it had been, it still has some impurities into it. So next, one of the things that we can do is we can put it in another vessel, container. We can put in an extremely caustic acid. I mean, acid that literally will eat your skin pretty quickly, burn your lungs really badly. And we can run an electrical current through there. And then that will help separate the gold. We put an anode in on one side. An anode is a piece of metal. On the other side is another piece of metal, and you put positive to one, negative to the other, and what's going to happen is the acid is going to break down the metals, including the gold, into very, very fine particles. And by putting the electricity to it, only the gold is going to be attracted to the gold anode. And it takes a while, but after a period of time, literally, all of the gold that was in the container has broken down into very small particles and has adhered itself to the anode. All the other metals, contaminants, simply fall to the bottom or are still suspended in the acid solution. When the process is done, we can take the anode out, we can go back to the crucible, put it in, melt it, and now the only reason we're melting it is to turn it into a shape that we want, because we now have pure gold. There's no other particles in with it. It's 100% pure gold. But again, the whole process is lengthy, dangerous, and hard. You think it's kind of hard on the gold, but the gold didn't get hurt in any way. Same thing God's doing for us. God's not allowing us to go through things that feel hurtful or for us to experience things just so that we feel fire, heat. That's not what he's out to do. He allows us to go through those things so that we become more mature in the refining process, so that we can become pure, come to perfection. Doesn't matter what stage we're at right now in the refining process. Probably each of one of us are in a slightly different stage. From time to time, each one of us feels uncomfortable about what we're going through, what we're experiencing. And at times, we feel like maybe God's forgotten about us, that he no longer loves us, that he no longer treats us like that nugget of gold. That is not the case at all. It's far from the truth. We are still loved, greatly cherished, and treasured beyond compare. James 1, verse 12. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life which the Lord has promised to them that love him. Let no man say that when he is tempted, I am tempted by God. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither does he tempt any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. But when lust has conceived, it brings forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, brings forth death. Do not err, my beloved brethren. God is in full control. He loves us immeasurably and will help us through the fire, the same as he did with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Remember that story? The king looks in, and what does he see? four individuals, not three. He threw three in, but he sees four walking around. God's right with us all the time. James 1 and verse 17, every good gift and every perfect gift is from above and comes down from the Father of lights, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. Of his own will beget he us with the word of truth, that we should be a kind of first fruits of his creatures. We have been chosen, adopted, not forsaken or forgotten. So Bion Baker, he had expectations of marriage and a family. And I think there was a time when maybe those expectations were starting to fade a little bit, because he was 42 when I was born. A firstborn, a son. And at 6 years old, he sat me down and he explained why he named me Aaron. That I was named with great intention. He had expectations for me. Expectations that his son, just like the Aaron of the Bible, would become a spiritual leader of the one and only God. I know he prayed for that. He died at 83. In his latter years, I suspect his prayers changed greatly, because he was watching his son run faster and faster towards the world. He probably felt from time to time that his expectations had not been met, were not going to be met, and wondered why. I'm sure those unmet expectations rose up emotions in him. Sometimes he was frustrated with his son. Sometimes he was disappointed in his son. Sometimes he was hurt by his son. But 5 years after his death, God tapped him on the shoulder, his son on the shoulder, said, "What are you doing?" And from that moment, I knew I was faced with a decision. I made the decision. I'm all in. Somewhere in God's script was a page that placed me at this microphone today. It wasn't on my script. I don't even know if it was on my dad's script. He just wanted his son to know God and to run after God. But he never got to see that in any way, shape, or form. However, one day soon, I know that my father, Bion Baker, is going to come face to face with Christ. And along with the rest of us, we'll be shown how the pages of the script played out before and after our life. And there will be a lot of oohs and ahs. Because we thought, nope, that didn't happen, wasn't going to happen. But for Bion Baker, something did happen. He just didn't get to witness it in his physical life. It has to be in God's timing, not ours. I have the same hopes and dreams, expectations of my sons. I may not get to witness all of it, just the way my father didn't get to witness all of it. But I have a totally different outlook today than maybe even my dad had. Because I know the script keeps playing out. God's plan is not hindered by anything, anyone, or any event. Do we fully realize and try to comprehend God's love for us all that he's done, all that he's doing, and do we realize that his love is never ceasing, especially when it feels like it's ceasing? Lamentations 3 and verse 22. It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because his compassions fail not. They are new every morning. Great is his faithfulness. Psalms 25 verse 10 says, all the paths of the Lord are mercy and truth unto such as keep his covenant and his testimonies. All we need to do is stop pursuing what we want and only pursue what we need, him. 2 Corinthians 4 and verse 16. For which cause we faint not, but through our outward man perish, yet the inward man is renewed day by day. For our light affliction, which is but for a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things which are seen are temporal, but the things that are not seen are eternal. Today, our expectations of this society that we're living in are going unmet daily at a horrendous pace, and that's going to continue. Are we allowing any of those unmet expectations to cause us to break the second commandment, second great commandment of Christ? Are we hating others in this perverse society? Matthew 22 and verse 39, Christ says, and the second is likened to it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. On these two commandments hang all the law and the prophets. Despite all of our unmet expectations, are we willing to love everyone? Doesn't mean you have to agree with them, agree with what they've done or said, but are you loving them? Are you willing to help them at whatever opportunity is given to you? What about the first great commandment? Matthew 22 and verse 37, Jesus said to them, thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, with all thy soul, and with all thy mind. This is the first and great commandment. If we knowingly, willingly decide to break either or both of these, there is only one place for us. Will that place meet our expectations? We're living in tough times and in a tough place. Let's look at what Christ said to the church in Pergamum. Go back to Revelations 2. Revelations 2 and verse 13, he says, I know where you are living, where Satan's throne is. Yet you are holding fast to my name, and you did not deny your faith in me, even in the days of Antipas, my witness, my faithful one, who was killed among you where Satan lives. But I have heard a few things against you. But I have a few things against you. You have some there who would hold to the teachings of Balaam, who taught Balak to put a stumbling block before the people of Israel so that they would eat food sacrificed to idols and practice fornication. So you also have some who hold to the teachings of the Nicolaitans. Repent then, if not, I will come to you soon and make war against them with the sword of my mouth. We can't allow ourselves to set unrealistic expectations of this world. Doing so is going to lead us to sin. Romans 12 and verse 2, we know this verse. And do not be conformed to this world, but be transformed by the renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. When we feel like our expectations have not been met, we have to go to God If our expectations were of him or ourselves, we need to ask him about that. We should also share our disappointments with others who will help keep us in check whether or not our expectations were logical, realistic, or if maybe they should have changed with circumstances. There's one last area of unmet expectations we need to consider. What about the unmet expectations of God that he has to experience every day? Go back to Malachi. Here there's a remnant that is back in Judah, and they've done some rebuilding, but they don't quite see God's blessings in all that they do. In Malachi 1 and verse 2, he says, "I've loved you, said the Lord, yet you say, wherein hast thou loved us? And he says, was not Esau Jacob's brother, saith the Lord, yet I loved Jacob." And remember what Jacob was promised, that his seed would be spread around the world. "And I hated Esau and laid his mountains and his heritage waste for the dragons of the wilderness." The people of Malachi, they were expecting the great miracles and blessings of the past. God reminds them that he did and still loves them. But then he has to remind them over the next couple of chapters that they've been offering polluted sacrifices, that they've been profaning the covenant that he made with them, that they've been robbing God in tithes and offerings. God has expectations of us to keep the commandments, including the seventh day, to keep the food laws in Leviticus 11, to keep his appointed feast in Leviticus 23. Again, the spring holy days are right around the corner. Are we going to keep them to the fullest of our knowledge, giving God all the glory and honor that he deserves? Are we preparing for those holy days? Not just physically, but even spiritually. That means, are we already looking at ourselves, acknowledging that there is still sin within us, but are we being willing to remove that sin despite the hardship that might feel like? Are we doing all we know to do that he expects of us? Are we willing to make new changes as he gives us new and deeper knowledge? Most of all, he expects us, it's in the first commandment, back in Exodus and Deuteronomy, that we treat him as God, the one and only God. Do we treat him as the only being that can help us through the next page of events? Do we realize that great expectations, whether we set them up or God has set them up, great expectations require great grace, great humility, and great forgiveness? When that person doesn't show up when they said they would show up, are we willing to offer grace, humility, and forgiveness? Because God has made it very clear he's willing to offer us grace, humility, and forgiveness. Do we remain in his image and give the same to others? He keeps affording us opportunities as examples to others. Do we remain in his image? Do they see him through our lives? Do we love God as he loves us? Another way to turn that around is, how would it go if God treated us like we treat him? Well, I prayed yesterday. Don't need to do it today. I read a chapter or two in the Bible last week. Don't need to do it today. Yeah, I know that's kind of important, but I'll try to get to it next month. What about, no, I can't do that. No, I'm not going to do that. What if God started throwing some of those excuses back at us? God has and still is fulfilling what felt like unmet expectations for Abraham, for Jacob, for Leah, for Brian Baker, for you and I. If we decide to give up now, we may never see all the miracles, the love, the mercy, justice, and perfect timing that he used to unroll his script. We need to keep in mind that God is not out to destroy us. He's simply purifying us from sin, because he cannot dwell with sin, but he wants to dwell with us. And as we're purified as individuals, we're also to be purified as the body, the church, the bride of Christ. Ephesians 3 and verse 14. For this cause I bow my knees unto the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, of whom the whole family in heaven and earth is named, that he would grant you, according to the riches of his glory, to be strengthened with might by his Spirit in the inner man, that Christ may dwell in your hearts by faith, that ye, being rooted and grounded in love, may be able to comprehend with all the saints what is the breadth, the length, and the depth, and height, and to know the love of Christ which passes all knowledge, that ye might be filled with all the fullness of God. Now unto him that is able to do exceedingly abundantly above all that we ask or think, according to the power that worketh within us, unto him be the glory in the church by Christ Jesus throughout all ages, world and without end. Amen. Are we meeting God's expectations, not just as individuals, but also as the church?